listening to CKUT 90.3. Angela, you're one of a million of political prisoners in the
world. From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Okay, we're going to get things started for this incredible launch event for a report produced by Independent Jewish Voices Canada. I'll turn it over to today's chair from the Hearing Palestine Initiative at the University of Toronto and also the Jewish Faculty Network, Alejandro Paz. Alejandro, take it away.
Thank you so much, Aaron, and welcome to everybody. Today's exciting launch of the new IJB report. So it's my pleasure to introduce our speakers for today. So Cheryl Nestle, one of the two authors of the report, holds a PhD from the University of Toronto, where she taught sociology and equity studies at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education from 2000 to 2012. She's also served 11 years on the steering committee of Independent Jewish Voices of Canada. Rowan Gaudette, the other co-author, holds a BA in history from Concordia University. He's currently completing a master's degree in global cultures at the University of Bologna, and has been a key activist in IJV No IRA campaign. After that, we'll hear from Dr. Anna Esther Yunis, who received her PhD from the Graduate Institute of International Studies in 2016. Her work focuses on white supremacist rule in Europe on the intersections of anti-Jewish and anti-Muslim racism. Then we'll hear from Dr. Sari Makdisi. Dr. Makdisi is a professor of English and comparative literature and chair of English at the University of California, Los Angeles. His most recent book is Tolerance is a Wasteland, Palestine and the Culture of Denial. And finally, we'll hear from Alex Neve. Alex Neve believes in a world in which human rights of all people are protected. He is presently an adjunct professor in international human rights law at the University of Ottawa and Dalhousie University, and a senior fellow with the University of Ottawa's Graduate School of Public and International Affairs. He served as Secretary General of Amnesty International, Canada's English branch from 2000 to 2020. So without further ado, I will turn it over to Cheryl and Rowan to introduce the report and the major findings. After that, we will hear from each of our panelists who will speak about their responses to the report. So Cheryl and Rowan, take it away.
So I'm going to start off here by thanking a few people, but then I'm going to give you just a brief overview of what this report is about. I'm hoping you'll all read it at some point. It is long. First, I want to thank everyone who supported us in the production of this report, in particular, the 77 interviewees who entrusted us with their stories. I also want to thank Professor Jim Turk of the Center for Free Expression at Toronto Metropolitan University for writing the report's preface. And I'd also like to thank all those who provided endorsements, and I urge you to look at the endorsements that we've gotten in the beginning of the report. And those include Laura Friedman, Danya Majid, Shireen Sekali, Neve Gordon, Shireen Razak, Anthony Lerman, Amos Goldberg, Alex Neve, and Sari Makdisi, who are with us today. My IJV colleagues I'd like to thank as well, Corey Balsam, Aaron Lakoff, Judy Haven, Larry Haven, and Sid Nestle, who gave us critical feedback, and my friend, as did my friend and colleague, Professor Jasmine Zine. And I really want to thank Alejandro Paz for making room in his busy schedule to chair this meeting. Finally, I want to thank my co-author, the indomitable Rowan Gaudet, with whom it has been a great pleasure to work as we negotiated our way across generations and continents to produce this report. In early 2021, as the intensification of harassment, intimidation, and even litigation against Palestine solidarity activists in Canada became more apparent, independent Jewish voices decided to undertake a major research project documenting how these tactics were creating a chilling effect on advocacy for Palestine, particularly in academia. The motivation to do this research was also sparked by the aggressive campaign, which has been mentioned, carried out by pro-Israel groups in Canada and elsewhere for the adoption of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance Working Definition of Anti-Semitism, a document that's come under vigorous attack by defenders of academic freedom and activists for Palestinian human rights. The IHRA-WDA represents an unprecedented attempt to frame criticism of Israel and of the state and of the political ideology of Zionism as quote-unquote anti-Semitism. While its proponents argue that this definition does not threaten freedom of expression or inhibit criticism of Israeli policies, our research findings demonstrate that this is far from the truth. And I think this is one of the strengths of the report and the important contributions it can make. So the report consists of two sections. The first is a discussion of the following: the critical importance of the question of Palestine, the strategies used to undermine and delegitimize movements for Palestinian human rights, a catalog of recent public examples of this in the US and Europe, and a detailed list of public cases of harassment of Palestine solidarity activists in Canada between 2009 and 2022. The report also describes activities of the 8 Israel advocacy groups named by those we interviewed as having deployed harassment against them. In the second half of the report, we describe and analyze the contents of our interviews in a detailed ethnography that elucidates the structures, norms, emotions, and behaviors that create the chilly climate in relation to any discussion of Palestine-Israel that supports Palestinian concerns or perspectives. In all, we collected 77 testimonies from 40 faculty members, 23 students, 7 activists, and 7 representatives of organizations. Testimonies came from faculty working at 21 universities in 7 provinces. They represented 11 disciplines, and 82% of those interviewed occupied tenured or tenure track academic positions. The 23 students represented 10 universities, and Rowan will tell you more about that in a minute. Approximately half of the participants submitted an online questionnaire, while the remaining testimonies were gathered from interviews conducted on Zoom. In analyzing the data, we identified the following categories, which reflected respondents' experiences: political intervention into hiring, restrictions on academic freedom, self-censorship in relation to Palestine, the potential impact of the IHRA-WDA, harassment by pro-Israel advocacy groups and media outlets, attacks from academic colleagues, ethnic racial identity and the experience of harassment, the emotional impact of self-censorship, harassment, and suppression of speech, political interference by university administrations, classroom and social media surveillance, sexist and homophobic slurs, anti-Palestinian and anti-Arab racism and Islamophobia, and finally, threats of violence, including death threats and threats of sexual violence. And with that, I will turn it over to Rowan.
Thank you so much, Cheryl, for that introduction, but also for your friendship and mentorship over the last 18 months. It's been a pleasure to work on this with you. So to introduce the findings from the student section of our report, as Cheryl said, we got testimony from 23 different students at 10 different universities. There was a large representation of both Palestinian and Jewish students among those interviewed, with small minorities of non-Jewish white students and other otherwise racialized students. What we found in these testimonies was various descriptions of doxing and smear campaigns, both in Canadian media, international media, and on Canary Mission, which, for those who don't know, is a website that creates profiles about activists, students, and professors, essentially attempting to make them make it difficult for them to find employment or other things by smearing them with false accusations of terrorism, et cetera, anti-Semitism. And we were the first ones to document how extensively this has been taking place in Canada, because usually Canary Mission is looked at in the US, where we found 125 Canadians on Canary Mission, 88 students and 34 professors, and also interviewed several of the people who were listed on Canary Mission, to where we got interviews and they described the impacts that it's had on their lives. We also found that without the limited protection of academic freedom and labor unions that professors enjoy, students are more often explicitly targeted by the university administrations. Things include last minute fees imposed on events to prevent them from happening, the banning of political posters, public disavowals often taking place in very public and aggressive manners, and disciplinary procedures imposed on students. Many students describe self-censoring for fear of repercussions, either from their professors or fellow students, with several Jewish students describing fear of engaging in Jewish spaces on campus, worried that they'd be ostracized and attacked for their beliefs. We also, as Cheryl mentioned, documented various forms of threats made online, especially, but also in one case, through the delivery of letters by hand to the graduate student mailboxes on campus. We saw various death threats, threats of sexual violence, and also we saw actual physical violence take place, often in the context of protests and ongoing activities on campuses. We also documented the extensive emotional costs that this often has on students, who described difficulty finishing things like theses or their studies more generally in the context of ongoing harassment campaigns. They described shame when they had been publicly named in media smears, burnout, as well as describing feeling uncomfortable on their own campuses and within their own student spaces. We found various instances where people described overlapping sexism and homophobia that was used to smear them or attack them, often relying on racist tropes as well. And of course, we found extensive use of anti-Palestinian racism, as defined in a recent report by the Arab Canadian Lawyers Association that I recommend anyone who hasn't seen it already to read. Especially frequent was the conflation of Palestinian identity with terrorism, or denial of Palestinian students' ability to narrate their own histories. And of course, in terms of emotional cost, Palestinians faced an extensively higher emotional cost, as this is an incredibly loaded context for them in the context of the intergenerational trauma caused by the violence inflicted on their families during the ongoing Nakba. And with that, I will turn it over to Cheryl to describe the professor's testimonies.
I'm going to tell you a little bit about the data that we collected from faculty. And first, I'm going to tell you a bit about our approach to this research project. So we basically used a research model that draws on decolonizing methodologies of social science research, which seek to challenge institutions, academic and otherwise, that prioritize colonial forms of knowledge production and maintain institutional commitments which impede Indigenous self-determination. Finally, we follow the direction of queer, feminist, and anti-racist research methodologies, which entreat us to consider how our positions in social hierarchies of gender, race, class, sexuality, and citizenship mediate our experiences. So my time is really limited, and I'll highlight some selected bits of data that we collected from our academic respondents. In terms of hiring, incidents involving hiring are of particular interest, certainly here in Canada, in the wake of the Azarova scandal, which made headlines worldwide, at the University of Toronto, where a potential director of the Human Rights Law Program at University of Toronto was hired and then was roundly attacked by members of the institutional Jewish community as a supporter of Palestinian human rights. So four of the respondents we spoke to reported participating in or witnessing hiring processes where candidates' political position on Palestine was used as evidence that they could be predisposed to discriminate against students who did not share their views. Candidates who had expressed critical views on Israel were seen as potentially divisive for the department where the hiring was taking place. And in a couple of instances, Jewish department members expressed that they would feel, quote unquote, unsafe if a candidate perceived to be pro-Palestine were to be hired. One candidate was advised by a senior colleague not to use the example of inviting a Palestinian speaker if a question about potential classroom controversies arose. The candidate was told, no, don't do that. Palestine is controversial at the university where you are applying, and it's not a good idea to mention it. Choose a different example. The respondent said, if this advice had been given once, I bet it has been given 100 times. And yet for the most, it seems unnecessary. Nearly everyone knows to avoid the controversial topic of Palestine in a job interview. A Palestinian scholar summed up the perils of their job search this way. The toughest part, of course, was making 130 plus job applications and not knowing if the reason you're not getting anything is because of how bad the job market is, your publication record, or Palestine. Academic freedom, which is, of course, a huge concern for us in writing this report. So eight of the faculty we interviewed reported that submissions to academic journals and book publishers were met with negative reviews, citing the author's critical stance on Israeli human rights violations. Three of them disclosed that articles that they were told had been accepted for inclusion in journals or edited collections did not appear in the final publications. In several incidents, submissions critical of Israel withdrawn by the editors from the publication at the last minute or reported to be lost. Academic respondents also reported incidents where research funding had been affected by their focus on Palestine-related issues. In one case, a national pro-Israel advocacy group intervened with the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council, which does funding for academic projects, in an attempt to defund the work of a professor who introduced the issue of Palestine into a research report. The respondent was subsequently deluged with requests. Deluged with Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act requests from the pro-Israel advocacy group and has had to seek legal support. Self-censorship, which has been a huge topic throughout this research. So reports of self-censorship figure prominently. And as one respondent commented, I purposefully would avoid discussing Israeli settler colonialism in my classes, even when relevant to our studies, in fear of being labeled as an anti-Semite and not being promoted to tenure. To me, this is an effective campaign to censor critics. Another respondent quipped, I'm not gonna lie to you. I don't teach about Palestine, and that's an intentional risk aversion. Several of those interviewed reported removing Palestine-related material from their work in order to satisfy reviewers or avoid controversy early in their academic careers. As one Palestinian academic reported, these are strategic decisions. For example, my first book included a lot more material on Palestine-Israel than in the original version. A reviewer suggested that I remove most of that for my own career's sake, I decided this was sage advice from a reviewer who genuinely was interested in seeing the book published. As a result, my first published book was much heavier on theory than I had planned. Also, I made a strategic decision to not publish opinion articles about Palestine until after tenure. I have followed that plan. As is clear from that quote, another reason that respondents self-centered was their precarious academic status as pre-tenure faculty or as academic job seekers. The impact of precarity on the practice of self-censoring on issues related to Israel-Palestine should not be underestimated. Several interviewees reported that as pre-tenure faculty, they avoided teaching, researching, or speaking publicly about Palestine. Other interview subjects talked about the emotional toll of self-censoring and the danger that the practice might become a habit. One respondent told us, "I and other academics, other activists, the media are always looking over our shoulders whenever we deal with Israel-Palestine issues. This constant apprehension takes a professional and emotional toll. For example, in the period when I was untenured, I was very careful not to be publicly active on the issue. For some, it is too easy to continue this learned activity once they receive tenure. Thus, the chilling effect is successful." Surveillance. 21 out of 40 academics interviewed reported being targeted by campus pro-Israel student groups and or by external pro-Israel advocacy groups, which have attempted to shut down or forcefully disrupt campus events about Palestine, launched public slander campaigns against pro-Palestinian faculty, or lodged complaints with university administrators against faculty. In addition, we identified 88 Canadian students, as Rowan has already mentioned, and 34 Canadian professors who have been targeted by Canary Mission, a site which publicly identifies and vilifies hundreds of Palestine human rights activists. For some of those targeted there have been serious professional and social consequences. The use of Canary Mission to deny entry to Israel was cited by the 2020 United Nations report of the Special Rapporteur on contemporary forms of racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related intolerance as a form of digital border technology that violates equality and non-discrimination rights, as well as freedom of expression protections, and leaves those whose rights are violated with limited avenues of redress. Irish scholar David Landy characterizes sites like Canary Mission as a virtual panopticon to put all academics on notice that they will be observed and attacked should they criticize Israel. To be clear, Jewish supporters of Palestine and academia are not protected from these forms of attack. Rather, we also face defamation, ostracization, and targeting from our community. As one Jewish professor told us, "Members of the institutional Jewish community have attempted to get me fired," but this person had tenure, "and or reprimanded, and or my activities on behalf of the Palestinian cause curtailed. They warned my university administration that the university was becoming known as the anti-Semitic university because of my activities." Concerns about surveillance have grown as universities increasingly embrace online platforms, particularly in the wake of the global COVID pandemic. One racialized academic who has had to deal with career-threatening attacks by pro-Israel organizations observed, "I am more cautious of what I say in my classes, especially if they are recorded and can be shared via remote teaching. I know I am being monitored by the lobby groups that have targeted me." One Palestinian professor told us, "I showed a picture of Haifa pre-1948 in class to make the point the land was not empty before then. Although I'd explicitly noted the PowerPoint presentation was strictly for students enrolled in the class and not to be shared or publicized, it was sent to the Hillel Foundation. And in turn, they sent it to the history department and to Jewish studies. The acting chair then sent it to the dean with a complaint. I was contacted by the dean and had to meet with him to explain. Luckily, the dean didn't take it forward. A white identified professor who was active in pro-Palestine politics outlined their experience with student complaints. "When presenting materials critical of Israel, I am constantly harassed by students who claim that I am anti-Semitic in class. This usually results in many emails and extra time holding discussions defending my position in office hours. Anytime Israel is mentioned in a critical tone in my classes, I am immediately charged with disseminating anti-Semitic tropes, even blood libel. The charges amount to defamation, and the threat hanging over professors is that they will be targeted by an active harassment campaign. Pro-Palestinian professors who have been targeted for their views describe to us the emotional toll on them of smear campaigns and incidents of harassment. Here in Canada, as in other countries, racialized individuals appear to bear the brunt of this targeting. A racialized faculty member who has been the subject of personal and professional attacks related that the emotional toll has been heavy. When things were at their worst, I was dealing with anxiety and high levels of stress. Even responding to this questionnaire is emotionally triggering. We were surprised to learn that scholars who identify as Palestinian reported having been, had been profoundly affected by harassment and intimidation. As might be expected, these incidents were saturated with anti-Palestinian and anti-Arab racism and Islamophobia. One Palestinian responded described the emotional impact of working in an academic setting where scholarship on Palestinian human rights is unwelcome. The threatening environment is always there. Just being of Palestinian origin turns my life into a constant struggle to validate that there is such a thing as a Palestinian with a past, present, and future. Another Palestinian interviewee described being made to feel like a biological threat. The emotional impact I feel is that I'm like a bacteria. I don't really know how else to describe it. I feel like I am this dirty existence, like I'm a dirty word. I have a dirty identity. And if I talk about it, it ruins everything. Like it ruins the department, it ruins their PR, and it ruins the university. Yet another Palestinian academic summed up their experience in a way that reflected the sentiment articulated by several other participants. The most common expression is that Palestinians are violent and backwards, and they're the root cause of the conflict. This is so prevalent. The level of dehumanization is really high. It's the reality of the structure as a whole, that you can stereotype, demonize, and dehumanize Palestinians, and that would not only be acceptable, but agreeable. So the issue of Palestine has been described as a poison chalice, inasmuch as the imperative to educate about the region and about the role played by local and global power hierarchies coexists alongside the awareness that doing so poses significant personal and professional risks. Attacks on pro-Palestine speech must also be understood in the context of the growing crisis in academia around issues of democratization and governance, precarious employment, debates over harmful speech, and the influence of private interests on consistently underfunded universities. The devastating impact of the chilly climate on advocates for Palestinian human rights gives us legitimate cause to worry about freedom of expression and dissent and about the growing toxicity of discourse around Palestine. However, as Nick Reimer reminds us, the normalization of violations of academic freedom means that the case for Palestinian universities should be made first with reference to the scandal of Israeli apartheid and only secondly on more procedural academic grounds. The chilling effect, as destructive and appalling as it is largely a stratagem designed to foster denial of the unendurable reality of settler colonialism in Israel-Palestine. Surely we must oppose this on many of the grounds delineated in this report. However, the ultimate goal should be to break through the discourses of denial in order to champion and amplify the Palestinian experience, a history and a present that calls for justice.
Thank you so much, Cheryl and Rowan. So now we'll turn it over to our three panelists who will comment. We'll first hear from Anna Esther.
Well, thanks, first of all, to Independent Jewish Voices for peace, for this invitation and the ability or the possibility to comment on such a timely and important report. It was already in 2010 that I came across Cheryl's work, as well as that of her students, realizing the structural and political similarities between Europe and North America at the time. With the report unveiling the chilling climate, the authors have shown, with elaborate detail and ethnographic interviews, the dangerous effects anti-Semitism accusations and the resulting public and private persecutions can have on people. Overall, there are more structural similarities than there are differences across continents, I must say, unfortunately. So some of the similarities I'm going to detail now. First, the report critically examines knowledge production within a democracy and its institutions, such as universities, an issue we definitely face in Europe too. The report also shows the psychological impact that public ostracization has on individuals, especially on those already racialized, sexualized, and colonized. The report also shows the direct racist structures these public campaigns follow. Again, this is also irrespective of differences in the political economy at play and how universities are funded, for instance, in Europe or in Quebec, apparently. The report shows how the badge of race, as I call it, has become the badge, not me, sorry, that's Du Bois, has become a badge of shame projected onto Palestinian activism, scholarship, and their supporters. Reading the report also shows how the... So having said all that, I want to focus my comments on the report on three main points. The first one is democracy, knowledge production, and anticipatory obedience. The second, race and knowledge production. And the third one, comments on terminologies and how to move forward. Democracy, knowledge production, and anticipatory obedience. The report points to the fact that the issue of Palestine highlights the importance to decolonize the university. Yet, as evidenced in the quote given by a Palestinian student on page 77, quote, "I grew up under Israeli occupation. I don't mean to sound brash or dismissive, but just to point out, this is what I expect. I have no idealized vision of society or politics that has been punctured by these things," end of quote. In this vein, I'm wondering in what way future reports could trouble the idea that universities are the harbingers still of radical knowledge production. When looking at the long history of settler colonialism and nationalism, of which Canada is still an ongoing project, it seems rather common that universities are already part and parcel of foreclosing, if not directly negatively intervening, in the production of decolonial knowledge, especially by those directly affected. To what extent do the interventions detailed in the report thus truly then conflict with Western democracies and the long durée of racial capitalism, and how do they differ from other historical experiences? Furthermore, so far in the history of racism, including anti-Jewish racism, most people have been killed, exploited, or persecuted by their own nation states. Even according to international law, if one was to prove genocide, apartheid, structural racism, one needs to prove and show that the money, manpower, and structures to implement the latter have been there, usually in the name of a state or on behalf of it. Today, however, the chilly climate, which is tolerated or directly funded by states, presents the racialized and the colonized as the actual threats to powerful Western nation states. The state thus curates and straddles a discourse either through policies or soon actual laws, as in maybe the UK soon from next year onwards, that produce anticipatory obedience on behalf of those not directly affected or too scared to become a target. As one Palestinian student recounts on the repercussions of such misinformation campaigns in the report, which impacted them finding work and even housing after university was over, quote, "Basically, their intention is to starve us to death, and we live in a capitalist world where there's no safety net. I don't think it's safe right now to talk about Palestine," end of quote. Race and knowledge production. In 2019, shortly after the racist attack on a synagogue and a donor shop in Halle, Germany, by a white supremacist shooter, the German Rectors Conference issued a statement condemning anti-Semitism and proposing to ban BDS from all campuses, which has been effectively implemented. Akin to the Islamo-Gauchisme accusations in France, which conflates scholars of colonialism and racism with an ostensible authoritarian left-leaning Muslim terrorism, the reaction of the German Rectors Conference after the shooting similarly conflates a human rights-based movement initiated by Palestinians under colonial conditions with white supremacist Nazi violence. This turbulent racial brouhaha ensues in a climate when now, for the first time truly, people of color, queers, and women are able to shape university or other structures defining the nation state. The badge of shame, however, which works as the badge of race, again, has led to Palestine advocates being seen as hostile space invaders. While some still think that this problem can be remedied with more publication on what is going on, others would argue that it has been going on for too long and that things only got worse. Overall, however, it is safe to attest that radical Palestinian knowledge production has become unbearable for many institutions by now, also in Europe. While the report states how some academics try to get away by still embracing white supremacy in academia, by mainly citing powerful white male or Jewish academics to maintain their so-called academic reputation, the report also shows how Palestinians are oftentimes not invited, circumvented as though it could be a stain, rarely acknowledged. In short, in the spirit of settler colonialism, Palestinians are symbolically and materially erased. The questions that ensue then ask if we just need to reform knowledge production in colonial times, or do we see knowledge production as just one of the many pillars upon which the colonial state rests? The latter could open up a debate with First Nations scholars, Black scholars in Canada and in Europe. Both approaches inform different strategies of organizing around Palestinian human rights. The latter in particular demands a transnational lens, as you have already done and started in this report. Terminologies and how to move forward. Finally, I would like to comment on the terminology chilly climate, which I'm also encountering with my legal representation, the ELSC in Amsterdam or Palestine Legal. From the very get-go, the term felt like a revival of Game of Thrones, along with Trump's allegory of winter is coming. After all, when was the climate not chilly for Palestinians, who are now also called the sand N-word, according to this report? I understand the terminology to be easily understandable, yet I don't believe it is fully representative of what is actually going on. In so-called decolonial times, where states become the harbingers of anti-racism policies, a colonially constituted war on Palestine, as Rashid Khalidi calls it, has morphed into a war on anti-Semitism, akin to the war on terror or war on drugs. In this vein, reading the report and the structures of intimidation, harassment, and assault that it delineates, I'm wondering if the terminology of a, for instance, transnational political apartheid for Palestinians and their supporters wouldn't be more poignant. Steve Biko, one of the most prolific anti-apartheid activists in South Africa, understood apartheid as a transnational system maintained by capitalist and imperial structures. He also argued that when the colonized began framing their own ways of doing politics, white liberals would perceive those as unsavory, radical, and militant, imposing civility discourses, which also seems something quite common according to the report and also in Europe. Hence, moving away from chilly climates in terms of terminology and to a transnational and transhistorical understanding of apartheid would also allow us to see apartheid as a structural successor to settler colonialism and genocide in the global project that is race. This might be depicting Palestinian reality more clearly than a chilly climate, where the undertone rests with me not having brought or maybe not being able to afford enough warm clothes anymore. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Anna Esther. And now I would like to turn it over to Sari Mati.
Thank you. I have to say, although I read the report when Cheryl was going through, just, you know, giving the examples that she was giving earlier, I mean, it brought back memories of my own sense of, that any Palestinian will know from being in the North American Academy, that sense of alienation and discomfort and, you know, the sense of feeling almost being made to feel guilty for bringing up the question of Palestine and the injustices that the Palestinian people face, and you know, for that matter, which is the flip side of the thing, the horror of the Zionist project in Palestine and what it's doing to people up to this present day. We all know, we've all, I assume, following the news recently and the murder literally every single day of one or another or two or three or four Palestinians in Palestine, many of them children, and you know, what's happening is shocking. And so, even though Cheryl's those lines, both from the report and from Cheryl's presentation here, brought back that sense of discomfort, I realized that, you know, one thing that we need to think about is a way of turning that discomfort around. I think that's sort of what Anna Esther was getting at a minute ago. In other words, we need to be able to move from a feeling of us feeling uncomfortable, being made to feel uncomfortable for bringing up the question of Palestinian rights, to making people who defend the brutal injustices taking place in Palestine, making them feel uncomfortable. I think that's a really, really major part of at least one of the ways forward out of the conundrum that we find ourselves in. So basically turning the tables, in other words. And I know, I realize that's easier said than done, although it's something that I'm trying to do in my own practice, my own writing, my own, you know, public pronouncements, as much as I can, because I think that's a very, very important thing. Having said that, of course, you know, as the report demonstrates, you know, it adds to the accumulation of evidence that has been already accumulated, including work by Palestine Legal and other kinds of researchers on the incredibly repressive atmosphere for people who work on Palestine in North America, or, you know, obviously, as Anester is saying, also in Europe, you know, which also is ferociously repressive, particularly in Germany, but also in France and in Britain as well. The report reminds us of the incredible damage being done to people's psyches, for one thing, but also obviously their professions, their careers, their sense of their ability to express themselves and their ideas and their work. But also, and I think this really is important, as I said, it goes back to when Cheryl was talking. I'm not blaming Cheryl for this, obviously, but it's the sense of personal discomfort. We, in an academic setting, we sometimes tend to discount that, but actually it is very significant. The kind of the psychical damage that one sometimes has to endure it takes a very serious toll on you, even if you're not working in Palestine particularly. Just the fact of being Palestinian or being somebody who advocates for Palestinian rights, it can take a toll on you psychologically. There's no discounting that. There's no getting away from it. There's no denying it. And the report gives us plenty more evidence to work with on that front. Having said that, I think it's also important to think. We might almost reach to what Keats once called negative capability, to hold kind of conundrums in our own mind and think these things through without necessarily finding easy resolutions. So when we look, for example, at Canary Mission, which came up in the report, it's already come up in our discussion today. On the one hand, we can, as Cheryl, I think you're quoting somebody, I can't remember, it was somebody you were quoting in the report, I think, but one can look at Canary Mission as a kind of panoptic, you know, sort of surveillance mechanism. And of course, that's part of what Canary Mission is the logic of the panopticon, after all, is that, I mean, as Bentham drew it up, is the idea that you get prisoners to look at themselves rather than that you don't actually need a guard. You just get the prisoners to do their own self-surveillance and they'll behave accordingly. And that is part of the effect that Canary Mission, seeks to enforce. There's no question about it. On the other hand, if you've read Canary Mission, I think this is what I meant about negative capability. We need to hold both these things in our minds simultaneously. So on the one hand, it looks like, and it certainly can function as a viciously repressive and, you know, panoptic kind of apparatus. On the other hand, quite frankly, it's a joke, you know, at the same, like literally the what they say about people are they're caricatures, they're laughable, they're absurd what they say. And so I think this contradiction of the kind of the severity with the comical nature of the phase we're going through right now speaks to something that's really, really, really important. And it's something that it's a point that I often try to make on when I'm talking about the question of Palestine in various kind of public setting, which is to say that we can look at this incredibly repressive atmosphere that we're all experiencing in different kinds of ways. And I do not for one second discount the reality of that repression. As I said, I've experienced it, we've all experienced it. I'm not saying that it's not there, of course it's there. On the other hand, what looks like this gesture of power by powerful institutions allied with states and with state interests and with other sorts of powerful resources and institutions and so forth is also, at the same time, it's also an act of desperation on their part. It is an absolutely last gasp, desperate, clutching at straws to try to stop the discussion of the question of Palestine, ultimately, and then the representation of Palestinian rights. That is also what it is. It's an act of total desperation. This is why we have to kind of hold these contradictory ideas in our heads simultaneously. it's not just about power. In fact, it's not about power, actually. It's about desperation, which is to say it's about weakness. And that's a really important point we can't also let go of in this atmosphere, no matter how repressive it is. Powerful institutions don't need to do this kind of work if they're confident in their own power. The fact that these people are not confident in their own power is why they have to do what they're doing. If we back up 20 years ago, 30 years ago, yeah, it wasn't, I mean, like, I remember when I went to university, you know, 30, what was it? I've forgotten. I forget these numbers, but 30, 40 years ago, whatever. I remember very, very clearly, you know, having to represent the idea that there are people called Palestinians and that the Palestinians ought to have rights. It was like elementary work 30, 40 years ago. The atmosphere was not nearly as repressive then as it is now. And I think we can all recognize that the atmosphere is becoming more and more and more repressive, but it's becoming more and more repressive not because the institutions that we're confronting and the forms of injustice that we're confronting are becoming more powerful, but rather because they're becoming weaker. And the weaker they get, the more desperate they become. And the more desperate they become, the more vicious they act, the more viciously they act. And that's also what we're seeing. That's why I think we need to see it as also announcing kind of the end of a certain stage. The end of a certain moment. It's the beginning of the end. It's not like a climax of power. It's on the contrary, I think, the diminishment of a certain kind of power, because they know there's nothing else for them to hang on to. So another really important point that I want us to register, again, not to diminish the report and what it very, very clearly documents and the forms of repression and punishment and so forth. There's no denying any of that. I just want to also keep in mind these other possibilities in our minds while we're discussing them, which is to say that if you think about it in an academic setting, the people who advocate for Zionism or for the repression of Palestinian rights have, in an academic way, they've lost all the arguments. They've lost all the arguments about 40 years ago. They don't really have arguments anymore, which is why they've now abandoned argument altogether. What they're doing is they're basically going to war against argument itself. That's essentially what this represents. That's, again, why I see it as a completely desperate, sweaty gesture as to what can we do? Well, we've lost all the arguments. Well, let's stop anybody else from arguing. I don't think that's a very smart way for them to proceed. I think, again, I see it as a gesture of desperation. They're not stopping, they're not succeeding in stopping argument, they're not succeeding in stopping reports like this or work that goes on Palestine. No matter how much damage they do, they can't, at the end of the day, they will not be able to attain their objective, ultimately, is what it comes down to, I think. In terms of as to where we can go from here, I think what Anister was talking about is a very, very important set of possibilities, building towards a transnational network of anti-apartheid activism and writing and expression is very, very important. I think the other thing that's very important is, and it's sort of, it's the flip side of that really, is building alliances locally on other on our university campuses and other places as well with people who are, you know, indigenous activists or black activists and so forth, other minority groups and immigrant groups and so forth. So I'll stop there and see if there are other things to be said later. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sari. And I would now turn it over to Alex.
Thank you so much, Alejandro, and thank you to everyone for the opportunity to be part of the launch of this much needed report. And I just note that I'm honored to be doing so from unceded and unsurrendered Algonquin Anishinaabeg territory. I'm going to share three brief remarks, which I hope will kind of jibe with the three questions we've been asked, but I've structured it a little bit differently. The first is a few words about human rights context. Obviously, I do not need to remind this group of the grim human rights reality at the root of why the concerns highlighted in this report even arise in the first place. But we have to always bring ourselves back to that. This reality of decades of war crimes, crimes against humanity, military occupation, and a reality, of course, in which those human rights violations have only intensified insecurity. They've in no way ever contributed to crafting peace. And Israeli forces and Palestinian armed groups each bear responsibility for that reality. But for today's purposes, of course, what needs to be specifically highlighted is that during 55 years of occupation, Israeli forces have been responsible for unrelenting human rights violations. I could not begin to lay out all of the authoritative, independent experts, UN bodies, human rights organizations, humanitarian groups, academics, judicial bodies, and others that have issued comprehensive reports, court rulings, and other documents to that end. Of course, more recently, that includes the recent extensively documented reports from many, including Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, making it clear that Israel's policies towards Palestinians amount to the international crime of apartheid. But here's the key point here. Denying this reality by attacking academics and students who seek to expose these violations and using these kinds of tactics to silence criticism and debate does not somehow magically make that all go away. If anything, it exacerbates and reverberates the harms because we know from all over the world that masking and disguising human rights violations only makes things worse. And that absolutely extends to what this report so thoroughly documents, attempts to vilify human rights critics as anti-Semites because they raise these issues and seek to advance the debate. The second point is just a few words about anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, which of course is the other very much related contextual human rights reality in play here. Anti-Semitism, as we know, goes back not just years, but centuries. It's toxic, it's racist, it's violent. And it is not just historic. It is obviously a very contemporary reality across the world, certainly in Canada. It demeans, it terrifies, it kills. Very small example, I'm currently serving as a commissioner right now on something known as the Ottawa People's Commission on the convoy occupation. All the Canadians on the call will know what I'm talking about, the takeover of downtown Ottawa in February of this year. And many of the people who have testified about the impact of the truckers' convoy have repeatedly highlighted what it was like for them to see the swastika flag flying prominently among the demonstrators. So one small, not insignificant reminder, anti-Semitism shows up in our streets in 2022. Of course, the same applies when it comes to Islamophobia, the harrowing reality of anti-Muslim racism and hate, very much a present of Canadian society today. We have the wrenching reminders of the Quebec City mosque attack, the killing of the members of the Afzal family in London, Ontario. The concerns that bring us together do not in any way negate how serious a problem anti-Semitism is or how vital it is that we have constructive strategies put in place to address it. Quite the contrary, I would say that unites us. But we are clear that the most effective ways to do so are by approaching anti-Semitism grounded in anti-racist frameworks, which includes recognizing that anti-Semitism and Islamophobia frequently have roots in many of the same extremist right-wing neo-fascist groups and movements, none of which is well served at all by conflating anti-Semitism and legitimate necessary criticism of extensive human rights violations committed against Palestinians by Israeli forces. Last point, a few thoughts about resolving human rights crises. For surely that's, at the end of the day, what we all aspire to. And here's a few key points that I think we just always need to remind ourselves are essential to any strategy to end human rights violations. First, there must be transparency and access to information. Human rights violators like nothing more than secrecy, and they thrive when their crimes are shielded from scrutiny. we must ensure that violations are brought into the light, are understood, and not hidden from the public. Second, building on that crucial transparency and information, debate and advocacy about human rights realities must not only be tolerated as some sort of inconvenient necessity, it actually must be actively promoted and encouraged to flourish. That's, of course, grounded in full respect for the essential human right that is in many respects a cornerstone to all other rights, freedom of expression. And that's precisely why this report is so important. It's showing us the ways in which that's a free expression about human rights violations committed by Israeli forces, chilled and stifled. Well, not only is that a human rights violation in itself, violation of freedom of expression, but it is detrimental to advancing the human rights change agenda more broadly. Third, there must be accountability. We live in a world in which those individuals responsible for some of the worst crimes that are committed are the ones most likely to evade accountability. Absolutely, we see that in Israel. Slowly, globally, that's been changing. International criminal courts have been established for some country situations. The International Criminal Court itself has been established. Universal jurisdiction laws are being used increasingly to chase down some human rights violators, but there's far to go, and we are hardly even at all out of the starting gate when it comes to addressing the endemic impunity in Israel-Palestine. And without transparent information, without honest debate, accountability remains elusive. And then to just throw into the mix here, we can never underestimate the irreplaceable role played by grassroots human rights defenders, ever. There's no situation where their efforts to expose, mobilize, educate have been anything less than pivotal to addressing human rights violations. Work that should be celebrated, but of course, that's far from the case all over the world, and absolutely when it comes to anything dealing with the rights of Palestinians, including by this insidious tendency to equate that human rights work with anti-Semitism. So to wrap up, governments at all levels in Canada, and I think we really want to keep that in mind, we're not just speaking to the federal government here, must take heed of this report. It is not anti-Semitic to oppose Israeli human rights violations against Palestinians any more than it is Islamophobic to call on Palestinian armed groups to halt attacks against Israeli communities, or Russophobic to criticize Vladimir Putin for the war crimes he presides over in Ukraine. Criticizing human rights violations is plain and simple defending human rights. It's a right enshrined in international law. It's a right that is the linchpin to advancing human rights change. And the way forward must ensure that that space for honest debate about the realities on the ground in Israel and Palestine remains open on academic institutions and everywhere across this country.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
CKUT. I don't know. But nah, fix it. CKUT, the number one radio station in Montreal. We give you the sun, the moon, the rain, the stars and the mountain. CKUT give you the word.
to another. In a world of unlimited possibilities, love itself represents an impossibility. What we desire without boundaries.